A modern musical with classical roots has wowed audiences worldwide, and today we're going to take a closer look behind the scenes. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insight into the creative process of storytelling. Folks, La La Land is truly a four-quadrant film, and I think one of the reasons it connects so well with audiences is because it's so unique that it's a musical that was not a stage play first, and that it was a musical written for the screen, directed for the screen. And I think that's one of the many reasons that it's so successful. So it was absolutely great to be able to sit down with writer-director Damien Chazelle to talk about his WGA and Oscar-nominated screenplay, La La Land. Damien had a lot of great things to say in my 10th annual Screenwriting Nominees Q&A podcast with the rest of the nominees, which I hope you've heard by now. So it was really fun to chat some more about the narrative and character decisions that went into La La Land, along with the practical process about how Damien integrated the music aspect into his screenplay as well. So I know you'll dig this episode. And speaking of things to dig, I hope you'll also check out my digital magazine Backstory on the iPad. It is the place to go for amazing television, film, and theater content. Remember, for you non-iPad folks, stay tuned to www.backstory.net for updates, because soon enough it'll become the fully functional magazine. We're currently converting our issues and figuring out how the new software we're using works, but soon enough you'll be able to see it all at backstory.net, likely even on Android tablets as well, so I thank you for your patience. So issue 26, our Oscar issue, just published, and if you have an iPad, I hope you'll check it out. Aside from being able to read the full screenplays of all the WGA and Oscar-nominated scripts, we interviewed the writers and had them present us with their favorite scenes, toughest scenes, and a bunch more, and comment on them. Plus, we show you all those pages that they're talking about and the lessons that they've learned from their own stories during this award season, so I know you'll dig those articles from the Oscar-nominated screenwriters. You could also read the full Blacklist script Burn Run, plus an interview with its writer, an in-depth piece about the graphic novel May Day, a look into what it took for James Mangold to get Logan made, and tons more. So I hope you check out issue 26, our Oscar issue. Right now, you could see our latest beautiful cover for issue 26. It's an image that has plenty of the characters from Oscar-nominated movies all dancing on the freeway, La La Land style. And you could also see our table of contents right over at backstory.net, so I hope you check that out. Of course, if you're so inclined, you could buy an issue or subscribe on your iPad, so thanks for considering that too. A quick note about the sound here. This episode was recorded in a conference room, and both of my mics had extremely strangely low levels, and long story short, I decided to use my backup device as it got both of our levels quite right. But yeah, that means that there's slightly an echoey sound of room tone, because this was recorded in a conference room that was kind of echoey. So I just wanted you to know why that sound was there, and it sounds a little different. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right into said echoey conference room as I sat down to interview Damien Chazelle about his Oscar and WGA nominated screenplay, La La Land. Well, so Damien, it's good to see you, man.
Nice to see you too.
We're gonna go back, you know, just I think a good place to start is with 2009's Guy and Madeline on a park bench. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of curious if you could remember, kind of in the years since, something that kind of you learned while doing that, that informed doing a musical again with La La Land. And I'm sure that there were a million lessons, but it was kind of a trial by fire in which you've been able to continue refining over the years.
Yeah, that was, I mean, it was certainly my first time doing a musical, my first time working with Justin Hurwitz, who did the music on La La Land. So I think we both tried to kind of use everything we learned on that when doing La La Land. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's there were lots of little lessons along the way. That movie had a weird kind of process, because we shot it sort of off and on over the course of a couple years. We'd sort of shoot a little bit, then have to raise money to shoot some more.
And right, so you were almost refining as you were going.
So we were kind of, developing and changing it as we went. But the philosophy in terms of kind of what we wanted the movie to feel like was sort of the same with La La Land. It was about trying to make a realistic musical and trying to find a way to take the old MGM musicals but ground them and sort of situate them in a real city with real people. Real problems, sort of everyday problems. Try to kind of strip a little bit of the artificiality away from the genre. So I think we just kind of learned how to do that a little bit, you know, and learned how to sort of stage numbers in a way that felt cinematic, long takes, things like that, but still had a kind of rough-hewn realism to them.
What did you learn about kind of integrating songs with screenplay? Because that's a trick that many people can't do, and you did great in La La Land, but kind of being able to make music a part of the narrative is not always so easy for people.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we learned that mainly just from watching a ton of musicals, just being sort of obsessive about the genre and the history of the genre, and just devouring musicals of every era, and not just American musicals, but a lot of French musicals and even certain, you know, Russian musicals and British musicals, and you know, just trying to kind of see what different cultures did with the format. And I think then just it was a matter of kind of picking and choosing what we liked. I think we responded to the idea of musicals where there's no unnecessary number, you know, there's no kind of number that you could just sort of easily cut out. Everything has a place. You build up to each number. You kind of take your time building up the emotion and the tension so that you can release it into the number. The number has a place to go and has a function. And also, you know, trying to really justify every number emotionally. You know, it's less about packing a lot of story into a number. It's about packing a lot of emotion into a number. And if a song is going to be there, it's going to be a reflection of how a character feels, and it's going to be the reflection of a feeling that can only be described through song. I think those are sort of the baseline rules that that I guess we kind of, yeah, we kind of formulated, you know.
Well, that's an organic approach, because that's what you need for a good screenplay as well, in which you're marking those emotional beats and making mm-hmm. sure that they're justified rather than out of nowhere. So that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Last question before we get to La La Land, Whiplash, I love. And, you know, I've interviewed you about it before, but again, with a few years behind you, it was a bigger budget, so a bigger step up. What was the lesson from Whiplash that kind of brought you forward to La La Land that helped you? Because essentially you were going from a $3 million budget to a $30 million budget by all reporting that I've seen.
Guy Madeline was basically a student film. Whiplash was my first, I guess what you'd call professional film, you know, first time on a real set with a full crew. So I think that alone kind of took some adapting, took some adjusting, to sort of learn how to use those resources properly and how to benefit from that and how to maximize that. So by the time I was on La La Land, which was not just a fully crewed movie, but, you know, a movie with lots of departments that had to be completely in sync, you know, I mean, I think the big challenge with La La Land was really in prep, was trying to wrangle all of these various elements, dance, sets, costumes, music, narrative, camera, all into one single statement. And so I think if I hadn't had the experience of doing Whiplash and doing, you know, kind of working with a full crew and going through the full traditional, I guess you'd say, process of making a film, making a professional film, I don't think I would have been equipped to handle what was a much bigger scale project with La La Land.
Would you say there was anything different about writing the screenplay for La La Land that kind of was something that you learned through a trial by fire on Whiplash?
Well, it's the longest I've ever spent on a single screenplay. You know, I mean, I wrote the first draft pretty quickly, but then we were continually revising it all the way up till the eve of shooting. So that's, you know, that's a good 6 years of tinkering, and a lot of stuff kind of we had to be flexible about. You know, a lot of stuff depended on how the songs would feel once we actually played them in full in the context of like a table read and put the whole thing up on its feet, and you know, could kind of see what was redundant, what wasn't, because everything is sort of guesswork until you do that. It also depended on the actors. I wanted the actors to have input. I wanted them to be able to really make the characters their own. I wanted them to be able to improvise, which again was about trying to preserve a certain kind of realism that normally you just don't have room for in a musical, for the obvious reasons that to make a musical work, you have to design everything to a T. There's no room for improvising on set. So we wanted to try to thread that needle and kind of reconcile those two things and make a realist movie, but still a musical. You know, that was a challenge, and I think that's part of why the script kept kind of, you know, being reshaped a little bit all the way through prep up until we started shooting.
Are there any big movements that you want to talk about that was kind of like a big reshaping moment that was something maybe that you had held on to for a long time that you then realized you could whittle away as you were getting closer to production?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly before we got into prep, you know, both characters were a little younger. I think the backstories were very different. Mia's final audition number was not about her own aunt. Sebastian was not trying to open a club. The sort of song structure was different. I mean, a lot of the songs themselves were different. City of Stars was only sung once by Mia. It was never a duet. It was never Sebastian's song. There were other songs that we had conceived that we dropped. So I think, you know, that there were, you know, there was a big 3-minute opening credits overture before the Traffic number. So there were lots of sort of things that I would say were not, you know, we're not talking about the core spine of the movie that stayed pretty much intact for 6 years. But a lot of the surface elements got shifted around.
What was Sebastian's character goal if it wasn't to open a club?
Just to play, just to be a musician.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that's really resonated with people worldwide is the fact that it's essentially a love versus work juggling act.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem that doctors and lawyers have, and, you know, anybody has, not just actors and musicians. I'm curious kind of what you learned about juggling with that process, in which there could have been a whole bunch of different endings. We could have seen the relationship work and then fall apart because of somebody's career as a crisis point. We could have seen, you know, them figure out a way to do it. There could have been a lot of different endings, but essentially you showed that it was their dedication towards their craft and towards achieving their work goals, which more defined their identity at that time in their lives than falling in love. Mm-hmm. And that's a really interesting thing for people to consider, especially as you flash forward 5 years in time. So what were some of the kind of the other variables that you played with when you were exploring that?
I mean, I think that was pretty much, you know, that was the gist of the story very early on. I think, you know, part of the appeal to me was that it's something that we haven't seen very often. Normally in movies about relationships that go off the rails, there's sort of an external thing that is to blame. There's, you know, a war or a disease or, you know, another woman or another man. Whereas here, I really kind of wanted the characters to almost, you know, when it comes down to it, when they're sitting on that park bench towards the end of the movie, to basically make a mutual decision, you know, that they're going to go their separate ways. And it's a mutually supportive decision. It's not, they don't split up in, you know, with animosity. And they kind of realize that life is taking them in these different directions, and they should probably not fight that. They should probably go where it seems like life is taking them. So I don't know, you know, I mean, in some ways, I remember when we were first kind of pitching the script, we'd get lots of questions of, well, who's the antagonist? Like, what's the obstacle? There's not enough, you know, conflict. And to our mind, I mean, the obstacle was, or the antagonist was, I don't know, life, time, you know, Mia and Sebastian themselves.
The measuring of dreams and how seriously you're going to take your dreams, per se.
Right, which is sort of an internal decision on their part, you know. So it was important for us to make the break of their relationship really be rooted in something internal rather than external. And to try to kind of weigh whether it was worth it, you know. And that's kind of where the final sequence comes from. But certainly, you know, I never saw the final sequence as a tragic sequence. I think, again, partly because this wasn't a story of people wrenched apart violently. This is a story about people who made a choice, and I think there's an argument to be made that it was a good choice.
This is totally new territory for me, because I'm not musically inclined, but I just want to know about your habit of kind of writing things that you know are going to be musical numbers into the middle of a screenplay. You and Justin have a great collaborating relationship, and he told us in backstory that you're so honest with him that he never has to guess. When you don't like something, you tell him ferociously how you don't like it, and it sends him back to the drawing board. But do you, I mean, because I know that you're musically inclined, do you sometimes play something and send it to him and say, go in this direction? Or do you verbally tell him what you're looking for using music or film references?
I'm not musically inclined the same way he is. You know, my instrument is drums, and I never kind of branched out beyond that. So, you know, I can't really tell him where to go melodically or harmonically. I can tell him where to go rhythmically sometimes. I can help him structure a song. It's true that sometimes, you know, I'll send him actually, I did this quite often. You know, I'd send him, files of me humming or something. You know, I can't sing, but just trying to kind of give him some sense. But any of the actual music making is entirely his. I would say he has more sway over my screenwriting than I do over his music, because, you know, he can write as well. So we're sort of relying on each other for feedback, I think, almost on an equal basis. Maybe I'm meaner about it. Though he can be pretty harsh on my pages sometimes. But we do, I think part of our relationship is about being brutally honest with each other, just so there's no wasted time.
Something interesting again was, you know, on your first film, you had written the lyrics to the song. Mm-hmm. And here, you know, you had Pasek and Paul that you were working with. How did you communicate with them? I mean, obviously they would have seen your script and what you're going for, but the interlocking of it all, when you're not writing the lyrics of the songs, but still making it feel like it's the same story with the same goals and the same character traits, what were the challenges of articulating that?
The script kind of read like a normal script, except for these numbers, which would be described a little bit differently than the rest of the script. You know, I'd suddenly kind of go into italics, and instead of filling out what people were saying or singing, I would just sort of paraphrase what they would be singing about and what the emotions of the number would be, and try to outline a little bit of what the visuals and the choreography and the geography of the number would be. So that was basically what Pasek and Paul had in their hands, other than Justin's demos, which were instrumental demos. It was a tough task for them, you know, I think, to kind of sandwich words into that structure and make it feel completely organic. The first song that they did was City of Stars. They actually did that as a, basically even before they had the job, they flew out to LA and played us City of Stars. And Justin and I were both, at that point the song was just called Ballad. You know, it didn't have any words, didn't have any title. I didn't have any idea what it was about, other than the emotional subtext. But I had no idea how that would translate itself into concrete words. And Pasek and Paul came in, sang the song for us, and that first draft of the lyrics is basically what's in the movie. That's how good it was.
Something really interesting about your screenplay for this is that there's such a focus to it, because it is really just Mia and Sebastian, with Keith as maybe the third largest character. Mm-hmm. And there's places where I easily could have seen you adding other characters to quote-unquote fill things out, right? Mm-hmm. Her family when she goes home, her roommates, you know, Sebastian's sister. Mm-hmm. But you didn't. And I'm just curious, was that through the art of reduction? Was there ever more to those characters that you kind of whittled away over those years? Because I think some of the success is the deep, deep focus that you have in these characters and their specific journey.
All of the things you mentioned were used to have more stuff. There used to be a lot more with Ryan's sister, Sebastian's sister, a lot more with the roommates, a lot more with Mia's family. You used to see the family earlier. In some ways, the only character I think who we didn't whittle down was Keith. I think it was, it was sort of a discovery process of kind of learning, you know, where our focus needed to be. And I always knew it would be, you know, sort of a, obviously like a movie about this relationship and a movie about Mia and Sebastian at its core. And we had to kind of prioritize that. But I think as we revised the script, as you say, we kept kind of whittling it down. And some of the stuff we shot as well and whittled it down in editing. It was a process, I think, of sort of, you know, shaving a bit here, shaving a bit there, and finally kind of arriving at the final shape.
Ooh, hey, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you all about my digital magazine, Backstory. It's an iPad magazine that focuses on the art and business of storytelling. Currently, we're an iPad-only magazine, but fear not, we're coming to the web very soon. You could check out www.backstory.net for updates. All of our issues have been converted, and we're now trying to make the technology active so you could read it on the web, and I can't wait for you to see the web rendition quite soon. I think we're also going to be available for Android tablets for the first time, so more on that when I find find out. But right now, issue 26, our Oscar issue, is our current issue, and if you have an iPad, you could check it out, and I hope you will. We did this really cool thing that we've been doing for a few years. It's in our Oscar Lessons section, where we have this year's Oscar-nominated screenwriters tell us about their favorite scene, their toughest scene, a deleted scene they missed, and also what it took to craft their memorable openings and endings for their screenplays. And not only do they tell us this, we publish the scenes they're talking about right there as well. And you also have the entire script to read if you'd like to, too. This year's Oscar Lessons participants include the writers of Arrival, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, La La Land, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. We also interviewed Lin-Manuel Miranda about creating his Oscar-nominated song for Moana, and Justin Hurwitz about his three Oscar nominations for the music of La La Land. Plus, Oscar-nominated cinematographer Linus Sandgren on shooting La La Land, along with Roger Ross Williams for his Oscar-nominated documentary, Life Animated. You could also read the full Blacklist screenplay Burn Run, along with an interview by its writer, Matt Tente, and read about what it took to create the popular graphic novel, Mayday. There's also full Sundance coverage, plus TV articles that include Zal Batman-Lige and Britt Marling on creating Netflix's The OA. Scribe Steve Melching and Henry Gilroy chat about writing on Star Wars Rebels. Gary Whitta tells us about his experience on Rogue One. And last but not least, co-writer-director James Mangold fills us in on what it took to close Wolverine's cinematic storyline with Logan. Plus, there's plenty of other pieces to explore as well, so don't miss this fantastic packed issue. And I can't wait to hear your feedback on it. Remember, if you have an iPad, the app and issue 1 are both still free, and each individual issue costs less than a beer at a hipster bar. So treat yourself. Look, I really appreciate all your help in spreading the word about and supporting my passion project. But now let's continue hearing about Damien Chazelle's passion project, La La Land.
It's interesting because people think of this as this big success, but you'd been living with it for 6 years. Not for too long, because I still have some other questions in the movie, but tell us some of your horror stories trying to set this up. Because I know that at one point it was at Focus, and they wanted changes ranging from, I want to say, a happy ending to bunch of other stuff. Or you tell me.
Yeah, that I think I read that somewhere. That's not exactly true. They it was at Focus at first. They didn't you know, demand any changes or anything. They just dropped the movie.
How long was it there?
Maybe a year or so.
How'd you get it dropped? Because sometimes movies stay in like a development hell and you have to wait 5 years to get it back.
They did us a favor. We had some allies there who were very kind to us, who pushed to free the project up once it became... I mean, the writing had been on the wall for a bit, but
right.
They had no intention of making it. So we got the project back. Fred and Jordan, the two producers, went off and started Pounding the Pavement with this now orphaned project. I went off and did Whiplash. And we kind of reconvened afterwards. I mean, that's essentially what happened. But it was during that post-Focus period that we started getting lots of notes and ideas from prospective, you know, buyers or financiers, ranging from, yeah, happy ending to throwing out all the jazz, making it all rock or pop.
Oh, really? So no jazz? Like, they would have made the movie if it was not jazz?
I don't know if any of these places would have made them. These were just ideas.
Right,
that
right.
Were proffered. There was a lot of, I think, you know, a wringing of hands about just how sort of inside baseball the movie seemed, you know, that it's, you know, the sort of, you have a character whose obsession is this like very specific sliver of jazz, and then you have another character whose obsession is being a movie actress, and those are just very specific goals that I guess the idea was that they wouldn't connect with anyone outside a few jazz clubs and a few, you know, audition rooms.
It's funny because the more you would water something like that down, there would be, I think, less of a reason to connect because you wouldn't be able to see the passion. So.
I can't agree more. I mean, I'm definitely a big believer in accessing the universal through the specific, you know, and that the way you make something universal is by really doubling down on how specific it is and getting that world right. And, you know, you don't have to be a computer programmer to connect with The Social Network. You don't have to be a baseball fan to connect with Moneyball. You don't have to be a Mozart fan to love Amadeus. And I don't think you have to be an actor or a jazz musician to connect with La La Land.
Absolutely. Just off the cuff, what do you think Mia's attraction to Sebastian is? Because I've heard some people debate it, in which, you know, earlier on, it's not so clear that he's even remotely interested in her. What do you think keeps her interested in him?
Well, I mean, you're saying early on in terms of...
You did something really funny.
I think they kind of get interested in each other at the same time. I mean, certainly she's interested for a moment in his music, then realizes he's a dick and loses interest. Then I think kind of decides to have some fun at his expense, because she's smart enough to sort of see what kind of person he is and that he's the kind of person who is just snooty enough that, you know, making him play some Flock of Seagulls cover is going to be sort of this, you know, crime against humanity for him. And then from there, we they sort of build up to something. But the idea behind A Lovely Night, their duet together, was to kind of have these two characters who by that point each have a reason to sort of dislike the other. They've kind of equally screwed over the other person a little bit. And yet we just know that there's something between them, you know, and that's the kind of magic of it, is that they think there's nothing between them. We know there is. And the city, the music, the filmmaking just starts to conspire to get them together. So it's just kind of like, you know, they wind up caged in basically by this beautiful vista and this beautiful song and the sort of magic of the whole moment. But they're the last people to realize that they're actually, of course, destined to be together.
You did something funny before that, in which you took the concept of a meet cute and you made it the anti-meet cute. And you did it twice, you know, in Traffic,
right.
They're flipping each other off. And then when he's walking out, you know, there's this girl that's completely staring at him, but he couldn't care less because he's so in his own, and just brushes up against her. But something that later pays off in your finale, you know, because you get to see that moment reconnected. When did you have that idea of him really just kind of blowing her off at first and them not connecting at all? Because it was actually endearing that you kept us on the edge of our seats of clearly these two are going to become lovers. Mm-hmm. When is it going to happen?
I think it was certainly all of that kind of structuring was figured out very early on. I think it was always a little bit at the heart of Sebastian's character that he was just a little, you know, kind of this guy at war against the world, fighting sort of a losing battle against time, you know, I guess, you know, that he's decided that there was a certain kind of music, a certain kind of culture that, you know, has disappeared, that and the world is worse off for it. Whereas Mia, Emma Stone's character, yes, she shares a love with certain things of the past, but she's also a modern, you know, person. She's able to kind of exist in a modern city in a way that Sebastian isn't. And so they kind of, I think he inspires her, she inspires him. I mean, it's as simple as that. But we wanted to try to sort of define them in relation to each other very early on, and sort of how each would react to the other. And it seemed like a fun way to kind of, delay the expected meet-cute, the same way we sort of delay the expected kiss a few times afterwards. There's a bunch of near kisses that we keep, you know, sort of having them fuck up.
I want to talk about your creative habit for a second. When you sit down to write, how important is outlining to your process?
It's become pretty important. You know, it wasn't always the case, but certainly the last few scripts I've kind of, begun by, I mean, just hashing out at least a very rough blueprint. But La La Land was probably the most kind of in-depth I ever went in terms of, you know, the writing before the actual writing. I mean, I think we wound up with a 60-page treatment, which we worked on for about, I don't know, 4 months or so.
Was it in basic prose form?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So then it was a matter of, you know, I mean, again, we kind of shaped and tinkered and worked that over for many months, and only once we were all really satisfied with that did I start the work of actually translating that to script.
When you sit down to write, how many hours a day do you write for, or do you give yourself a page count number that you want to hit?
I try to give myself the page count number. I usually try to give myself 5 pages. If I'm really ambitious, I'll give myself 10 pages, but I've tried that so many times and I never hit it, so it's kind of sad. So I think I've sort of agreed to 5, and even that is hard to hit sometimes. But I try to make the first draft feel like a very surmountable obstacle, you know. So I try to kind of, if you're going to give yourself anywhere between a 5 or 10 page count daily regimen, that means you're going to have a first draft in a few weeks. You know, I mean, you could have it in as soon as 10 days, say, depending on how long it is. But you know, at the most, it's going to be a few weeks, and then you'll have something. And I like that. It doesn't mean it always works, but I like kind of feeling like I can have the full thing in some shape or form quickly. Because that's the hardest part, is the blank page. Then once you have the draft, then, yeah, I mean, obviously in the case of this movie, I spent almost 6 years revising it.
What do you do if you get writer's block? If you get it, how do you battle it?
I almost always have writer's block, because I just, you know, it's a constant fight against procrastination. And I just procrastinate, you know. I watch movies, I read, I listen to music. I do anything that I can to avoid writing.
I'm curious, you know, there seems to be a turning point in the movie where Mia's on the phone with her mom, mm-hmm. and she's talking about how she's going to probably have to pay the theater to put on her show, and how Sebastian isn't really making a lot of money at the time, but mm-hmm. he's trying to open a club, and we see him hear it and kind of become, I don't want to say disgusted with the situation, but dismayed, and it almost seems like it's the impetus for him to go out and decide to join the band, mm-hmm. and go on the road and really try and be more responsible. Mm-hmm. What was going on in your mind for crafting a moment like that?
Yeah, that was a tough scene because it had to carry a lot of weight in a way, but without you kind of realizing necessarily the first time you see it how much weight it's carrying. But it is the turning point. You know, it's the moment when I think the honeymoon phase ends. It's the wake up call. It's sort of, you know, it's he looks up at his ceiling and he sees, dirty kind of water stain, and he sort of has that moment of realization that, you know, maybe I have to actually grow up. As he says later in defense, you know, as, you know, he's defending himself later at the dinner table, telling her that, it's time to grow up. It's time to wake up. It's time to get realistic. All the things that he has been brushing off until then, whether, you know, no matter who voices it, Mia, his sister, his bosses, you know, his various bosses who keep firing him, whoever it is, he brushes them off. And finally, you know, I think he hears the voice of someone he loves. I think it's just kind of, it dawns on him a little bit.
One of the things that was interesting to me was the rules of when you would decide to use a song. And there was a few places that worked great in your screenplay, but also could have been songs. It was kind of, I could have seen the scene outside of her house when he convinces her to go on the audition. Mm-hmm. And also you could talk about songs that were cut. But yeah, him outside of her house when he's really trying to motivate her. Mm. I easily could have seen that as a song. I think it works great that it's not. But I'm just kind of curious really to hear more about some of the lost songs, places that you might have had that weren't shot.
Yeah, so that was never a song. There was a little fragment of singing that Sebastian did shortly before then, when he's alone, sort of kind of after the one woman show, after Mia has gone back to her home in Nevada. It's just sort of a woe is me sort of ballad, but done very low key and very kind of just kind of a fragment. That was something that we dropped. Where they currently sing City of Stars at the piano used to be a different number, a much more up-tempo, big, full-fledged dance number out on the streets. So some of those things those were definitely some of the changes that we went through. Other than that, I think the basic structure of the sort of songscape was pretty much stayed intact. And it would just kind of be a gut thing, I think, for me and Justin. You know, we would just kind of try putting a song somewhere, and if it felt cheesy, we just wouldn't do it. You know, it's almost hard to describe. It's just sometimes you could just feel it or not. To me, you know, for example, him trying to convince her to go to the audition, that wouldn't work as a song, because there's too much, sort of story information that you have to get across. So he would have to actually, it would basically become a musical theater song. You know, he would have to be actually, you know, which means you're sort of almost literally translating dialogue to lyrics. Whereas the songs that we kind of preferred were more metaphorical, were more sort of approaching things at an angle. That was a direction I would often give Pasek and Paul. on lyrics is that nothing could be too literal. The characters couldn't be literally singing about what they were doing, except in rare cases. They had to be singing around it and using metaphors, whether it's City of Stars or whether it's the idea of someone in the crowd or the way, you know, these are sort of more amorphous ideas that you can sort of, they're concrete enough that you can latch onto them, but they are not, it's very different than a musical where you sing your actions, you know, you sing, your name is Mia and I met you over right there. Now I'm good. You know, even though we did try songs like that, you know, it was a matter of, I think, trying to, I mean, one thing I talked to them a lot about was, I mean, I think part of the reason why I liked that sort of the other approach was that, you know, a lot of the old musicals, a lot of the old MGM musicals were actually sort of jukebox musicals of their time. They were using songs that had been pre-written. You know, Singing in the Rain is all music that was written decades before that movie was made, almost all of it. And similarly, a lot of the other movies were not introducing new songs. They were kind of co-opting standards to be a part of their
narrative. Or Broadway musicals that were successful, yeah.
Right, so it was... but I mean, in the case of movies that were sort of just taking pre-existing tracks that hadn't been done in a story form before, then it became, I mean, those numbers, something like Singing in the Rain is a number that can exist on its own as a song. That's not, you know, he's never singing, you know, I just decided to turn, you know, my movie into a musical and now I'm happy because it's raining and I'm going to dance. You know, everything he sings is actually abstract enough that it can be completely removed from the context of that narrative, and that's because that song existed 30 years before. So even though that wasn't the case with this musical, we kind of wanted to take that approach a little bit, where every song would kind of have its own life, exist on its own, almost as though the characters were singing standards, even though they're not.
It's interesting. You seem to have had a decent amount of rehearsal time for this movie. How much did you have?
About three months of kind of everyone together on site rehearsal, and Ryan was rehearsing piano a little before that.
That's a lot. So what were the most important things that you learned through rehearsal? Because it's really kind of a treat these days to have that much rehearsal time.
Well, it helped. It helped enormously, just in every department, but especially helped to kind of have a lot of time with Ryan and Emma to really workshop their characters in between the technical rehearsals, in between the dance rehearsals and the song rehearsals, to really be able to kind of flesh out character beats, improvise scenes, workshop scenes, get stuff up on its feet. That was huge.
What was something that changed in the script? Was there anything that kind of out of rehearsal and workshopping that you realized was time for a rewrite or a tweak during that period of time?
I mean, almost every scene, I think, went through.
Really?
I mean, there was... I was rewriting during the entirety of rehearsal, during the entirety of prep, which was exhausting, but... But yeah, we were continually every week sort of issuing a new draft, and
I mean, that could be dangerous for some writers, because you might have something that worked and everyone signed on to, and then you could lose some of that if you doubt yourself. So what was motivating you to do that much rewriting as you were leading up to it?
Just stuff that we were finding out in rehearsals, you know, again, as we would do table reads, as we would do read-throughs, as we would put scenes up and you know, or shoot dance rehearsals, or just kind of get more concrete information, then, you know, it's sort of the problems reveal themselves. And I think
do you remember a big one in that timeline, like a big problem that revealed itself that you really realized, ooh, this is now a good chance for me to rewrite it?
Well, I think, you know, for example, the use of City of Stars and sort of that becoming Ryan's song initially rather than Mia's, or rather than Emma's, was sort of that was something that came out through a read through when we realized that it was taken away from Mia's audition number to kind of give her a ballad beforehand, that's an example. But that, of course, had a ripple effect. Then if you do that, then you have to kind of alternate the structure with Emma's character. You also have to figure out sort of how you're going to stage it, so we had to find a location for it and choreography for it, et cetera. So tweak the lyrics as well. So, I mean, every kind of decision like that has a ripple effect, and so it winds up kind of affecting the entire thing.
Just as we're wrapping up, I mean, I think one of the things that's really resonated with people is your fantastic ending. And you have all these questions in the air of what's going to happen to them, And you do a great bypass by jumping 5 years into the future. And then at the same time, that moment in which you rewind their lives and show the different paths or one of the different paths that it could have taken was really inspired. And you do it practically silently, you know, to music, of course. How did that look on the page as it evolved for you? What were some of the variants of it? And how did you perfect it into the place that you left it, which is the concept of him going with her to Paris and just playing in a club and, you know, kind of being by her side?
I think that was another thing that pretty much was, you know, more or less locked in the earliest drafts. Didn't change that much. It was again, though, you know, it was a little bit of a tricky thing writing or conveying on the page because it was all, you know, you didn't have the music or the visuals, so it was just sort of a lot of heavy descriptions, you know, 10 pages worth of no dialogue and just descriptions. But it pretty early on, I think it kind of, it worked more or less on the page. Like, people were sort of getting the idea. They weren't sure how we would do it, but they were at least getting the idea of what it needed to be. I think the challenge became in many ways sort of executing it in a way that would fulfill the promise of what was on the page. We knew that there was real promise or real potential there. And so each time you make a concrete choice, you're limiting yourself into that choice. So once the music was composed, once locations were found, once we started shooting it, you know, everything was kind of locking us into the certain direction. So we had to be really sure we were going in the right direction because we knew that it was the most important sequence in the movie, and the movie wouldn't work if it didn't work.
To my knowledge, your editing process was kind of long. Is that right?
Yeah, it was about almost a year.
A year. So, I mean, editing is the last stage of storytelling. What were the important lessons that you learned about your story in the editing room? Things that maybe you would tweaked in where they fall and appear in the story, or scenes that you realized you needed to cut? There's a lot to learn, so I'm just kind of curious what you went through in that year.
Yeah, I mean, we cut a lot of stuff. We tried cutting certain things and putting them back in. There was a lot of sort of reordering and shuffling of the deck.
Could you give me an example or two of things that hit at different places in your script?
Well, some of the stuff that we talked about earlier, you know, stuff with Sebastian's sister, or stuff with Mia and her roommates. You know, there were certain scenes there that were small scenes, but still scenes that we'd spent time on that wound up being cut. There was a lot of shaving done, you know, because you kind of find that you can say a lot with a little, you know, and things that you needed to hash out on the page are more simply stated on screen, especially when you have great actors, which we were lucky to have. You know, the opening credits overture, that went out the window. The second number with Emma and her roommates, that used to be about twice as long, so that got condensed. Stuff like that.
Cool. Well, I love the film, and
thanks.
I'm glad that it's found its place in the world. You've been very generous with your time, and I can't wait to see what you do next. Damien Chazelle, thanks a lot for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, man.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to writer-director Damien Chazelle for coming down to chat about his WGA and Oscar-nominated screenplay, La La Land. This episode in the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2017. All rights reserved. And folks, I want to thank you again for spreading the word about issue 26 of Backstory on the iPad. And also thanks for letting folks know that Backstory.net will become the fully functional magazine this year. We are also likely to be available on Android tablets for the first time as well. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment, which I kind of desperately need now, and use these funds to pay for all my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.